This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Jennifer Barnes, a deep green architect and sustainability consultant with over 20 years of project experience. Jennifer is principal of her design and consulting company, 55.5 Consulting. She is also co-founder of Biomimicry Puget Sound and of the Urban Green Print, a biomimicry-inspired project that identifies ways to strengthen ecological systems in urban centers. Jennifer Barnes is here today to tell us about the Seattle Urban Green Print and how it can contribute to environmental restoration. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you, Diane.
Would you remind us, what is biomimicry?
Well, at one level, biomimicry is about function, learning how ecosystems or organisms function, and then applying those same strategies to solve our own challenges more sustainably. So in other words, how does nature do what it does? And then how can we emulate those strategies in our own designs? It's pretty interesting when you really think about it. Organisms need to do a lot of the same things that we do. And so the core idea here is that nature has solved many of the same challenges that we're currently faced with. Organisms need to find nutrients, find shelter, stay warm or cool, move from point A to point B. But unlike us, nature does this completely sustainably. So how does she do this? How does she solve for these tough challenges and find a way to do it completely sustainably? Fortunately, of course, we have examples all around us of nature success stories, and biomimicry gives us a language to translate those stories into models we can emulate. So for example, researchers in Belgium got curious about fireflies. They learned that the profile of the firefly's exoskeleton is actually shingled in jagged, misshapen scales, and that reduces the internal reflection of the light that the firefly emits. So that allows almost all of the light that the firefly generates to be angled out rather than back in toward its body, and simply by mimicking that profile. Last summer, designers were able to create a 55% more efficient LED. That's really huge. So biomimicry is about function, but I would also say that at its heart, it's about something much deeper. It's a shift in perspective from thinking of nature as a resource, even if it's a resource that we cherish, to really understanding nature as a mentor. So remember being a kid, sitting in the grass or on the sidewalk, watching the bugs or staring at a leaf, that feeling of wonder or of awe. And that's a feeling that biomimicry helps us recover as adults. It might be the awe we feel of a new scientific understanding. It might be the awe we feel when we're deeply connected with nature. In whatever form, I think all of us know instinctively that nature has a lot to teach us if we will slow down and pay attention. So, of course, this is nothing new. This approach has been around a long time. Designers and engineers have been looking to nature to solve problems for millennia. But for the last couple of centuries, that wisdom has been pushed aside. And for many people, nature is a resource to be used. But now we're again at that point of remembering we are nature. We are part of the system, and it's time for us to take responsibility for how we're living on the planet and remember how to live within this context. One more thing in terms of what biomimicry is, I would be really remiss not to mention Janine Benyus and Diane Baumeister. In 1997, a biological sciences writer named Janine Benyus wrote a book titled Biomimicry: Innovation Inspired by Nature. This book has galvanized a huge surge of interest in the field. It really created the field. And she and her business partner, Dana Baumeister, and their organization, Biomimicry 3.8, have been instrumental in bringing the concept of biomimicry into the mainstream and helping many of us understand its potential.
What are the advantages of using biomimicry concepts in the built urban environment?
There are so many advantages. And first, I'd like to say that built environment or not, we can apply biomimicry to just about any challenge that we can imagine. Several of my friends and colleagues are applying it to organizational development. It's being used by businesses looking at lessons of social insects to learn how to improve communication and supply chains. The list just goes on and on. But yes, as an architect, I do see tremendous value in approaching built environment design challenges through the lens of biomimicry. Our buildings consume 40% of the world's energy. They produce about a third of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. So this sector has a huge potential for improvement. So in terms of biomimicry's potential value to the built environment, I don't think that it's an exaggeration to say that it's limitless. Because truly, I think that the lessons are everywhere. The challenge is for us to be able to shift our perspective to see those lessons. So we can learn from nature at every scale, big picture lessons, specific technical lessons. For example, organisms remind us to build using local materials. A beaver does not build its dam from tropical woods or out of sandstone. You know, it uses the resources that are at hand. Nature also teaches us that we should be able to make everything we need out of benign ingredients. Green chemistry, thankfully, is growing in leaps and bounds. This is really important right now. We should be able to live and work in buildings that are constructed of 100% healthy materials, and that also, at the end of their useful life, simply become food for the larger system. And of course, right now, that is not happening, but people are starting to wake up to the fact that this is really important. Another big topic right now is resiliency, and we can learn a lot about resilience from nature. Whether you're in a red state or a blue state, this is a big topic. And it's really interesting when we think about what we value in buildings, we tend to value efficiency above all else. Well, it turns out that nature is resilient because of diversity and redundancy and variation and decentralization. And these are things that we value engineer right out of our building designs. But in fact, if we want our buildings to be resilient, these are some of the characteristics that we need. Then at a finer scale, every living organism on the planet has lessons to teach us that can help us solve really specific problems. Whether we're studying a camel's nostril and the condensation and evaporation that happens inside of it to help us design a more energy efficient desalination plant, and that's happened in the Canary Islands, or whether we're learning about the deep pile under fur of a reindeer so that we can understand how to insulate more effectively, there are scores of lessons for the built environment just waiting to be read in every organism on the planet.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Jennifer Barnes, co-founder of Biomimicry Puget Sound and of the Seattle Urban Greenprint Project. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What is the Urban Greenprint?
Well, the Urban Greenprint is a project that applies biomimicry at a city scale. So we are asking, what can we learn from nature that will help our city be more resilient, more healthy, more livable? This is a project I've been working on the last couple of years with a friend and colleague, Alexandra Ramsden, who's the other co-founder of Biomimicry Puget Sound and director of sustainability at Rushing. And I want to say we are very, very grateful to the Bullitt Foundation for helping us get the project off the ground with an initial grant that we submitted in collaboration with Biomimicry 3.8, and for also awarding the project a second grant last year for the phase two work that we're currently doing. So we've started the Urban Greenprint Project in Seattle, and we realized early on that if we want to learn from nature, it makes sense to understand how our pre-development forest and wetland functioned before urban development changed the balance. How can our city function like those ecosystems did? So I want to be really clear that we're not talking about reforesting the city. We're talking about understanding how that forest functioned so that we can then replicate those functions in our buildings, in our infrastructure. We're also looking at current conditions so that we can understand how our ecosystem is functioning now and also get a sense of where our leverage points are. Because we want this work to be truly impactful and lasting, we're connecting with community partners and initiatives that are already in place. There is a lot of great work happening around Seattle. We don't want to replicate it. We simply want to add nature's perspective. So we know that we need to connect with the energy of this community if we want to create work that's regenerative, work that continues to thrive and increase in vitality long after the project is complete. So to talk a little bit about our process and what we're doing, the first thing we did when we kicked off the project was that we held several roundtables and invited people to come together to talk about what our most pressing local issues are. These roundtables helped us narrow our focus to three areas of research: CO2, biodiversity, and water flows. We've researched historic and current conditions of those ecosystem issues, and then we held workshops through our Biomimicry Puget Sound network. The outcome of those workshops was that we identified several strategies from nature that we could emulate in our built environment today to help restore ecosystem function in Seattle. Some of those strategies are crazy. They're off the wall. They need more research. And they're exciting. They're very innovative. Others of those strategies that came out of the workshops are very practical. They're very easy to see how they would be immediately applicable. And I will say that some of the most exciting moments in all of the Green Print work, they've happened because of the diversity of people that have come to the table. It's really not often that you have biologists and designers and regulators and engineers and students and material scientists all coming, all attracted to one workshop. And that's the kind of energy, those are the kind of people that we've brought to the table that are attracted to biomimicry. And so these people have come together, they're getting creative together, they're making connections with each other that create more than just the project, you know, connections that leave the room and then take on a life of its own. So the energy around those workshops has been really amazing.
Would you just underscore the goal of your project?
Sure. The goal of the project is to help restore ecosystem function in the urban area. What can we learn from nature to help our city be more resilient, more healthy, more livable?
Let's talk now in more detail about the three areas that you identified in the workshops: water, carbon, and biodiversity. So first, how can water pollution be prevented by the built environment and the original ecosystem function restored?
This is really exciting time because we're talking about how our buildings and infrastructure begin not just to do less damage, but to actually begin to regenerate ecosystem functions. So I'll give a few examples of water, and I'll start with a revelation that we had about water. And this was nothing secret or nothing super technical. It was just something that we had not thought about before. And I venture to say, I bet very, very few designers in the region have thought about water this way before. So we know in this region that polluted runoff is probably the biggest environmental problem that we face today. We know that we spend a lot of time and energy and money for very good reason dealing with polluted runoff issues. We know also that when it rains in downtown Seattle, most of that rainfall runs off the site. A lot of it does become polluted runoff. And it turns out that we've learned that 87% of the rain that falls runs off, 13% evaporates, and basically nothing infiltrates. Well, before about 1850, most of what is now downtown Seattle was forest. Hundreds of streams crisscrossed the area. There were swampy spots and springs here and there. First Avenue was at the edge of a bluff that dropped steeply to tidal flats, and there were wetlands in South Lake Union and the Duwamish. But most of downtown was forest. So when we think about the rain that fell on that forest, the water flow numbers are much, much different, of course, than they are now. Not surprisingly, a lot of the rain that fell infiltrated into the ground, just about half. What really surprised us was we realized that when it rained, 50% of the rain that fell was used by the plants and then returned to the atmosphere. So half of the rain that fell never even made it to the ground. So what this tells us is that if we can get our evaporation numbers anywhere close to pre-development, we can go a long way towards solving our polluted runoff problem. So now let's think about biomimetic strategies. How does nature manage water? And specifically, how does nature evaporate? What can we learn from nature that will help us evaporate more water downtown and get us closer to those pre-development numbers? So there are lots of strategies and organisms all over the globe, but we can also simply look at the structure of our own Northwest forests for clues. So when we look at that structure, we see forms and processes we can emulate in our building designs today to increase evaporation. The feathered nature of the canopy breaks up large raindrops into smaller ones that are easier to evaporate. The layered and textured branches of our trees provide surface area that holds onto the water, again, increasing its chances of evaporation and also slowing it down before it hits the forest floor. The detritus of the forest floor, the whole forest floor itself, acts like a sponge and holds onto that water until it can evaporate or sink into the ground. It slowly releases it. So we can design functional equivalents for all of these elements: staggered roof profiles, roof and building cladding that's textured with lots of surface area, blue roofs that hold water, active water features, materials that soak up water and slowly release it. The more water we evaporate, the less waterborne pollution will run off into our water bodies.
So we've spoken about water, but what opportunities do you see in Seattle's urban environment to restore the function of earlier ecosystems in regard to carbon and biodiversity?
We have learned some really interesting things about local carbon flows, and there are plenty of opportunities to help restore some of those functions. There are a lot of opportunities to restore carbon storage capacity in our city today. One of the things that we've learned from our research is that wetlands store a lot of carbon. In fact, they store 5 times the amount that temperate forests do. And we know that central Puget Sound, we have lost more than 2/3 of the wetlands that we had pre-development. So we have a lot less storage capacity. So one of the questions we've been asking now is, how does nature store carbon long term? Well, it turns out that globally, soils store far more carbon than all of the terrestrial vegetation and all the carbon in the atmosphere combined. So most soils in urban areas have been completely degraded. And so simply by adding compost, we increase the carbon storage capacity. And if our compost comes from our local biosolids, which are, you know, biosolids from our valuable resources from our local wastewater treatment plants, we can start to close the nutrient loop at the same time. So in a process that feeds itself and becomes better and better over time, those same amended soils can hold more stormwater, support more biodiversity, and in turn, that can all generate more carbon storage capacity in the soil. And while I'm talking about supporting biodiversity, I would just add that we could do a whole segment on the importance of urban biodiversity. This is so important, and it's not talked about very much. But I will just say to that point that it would be very easy in Seattle to support healthy urban biodiversity simply by providing habitat corridors. Insects and animals need habitat corridors for food and protection. They don't just thrive in isolated pockets. They need connections between green space. So we can strengthen biodiversity tremendously by developing habitat corridors with native species that support native biodiversity. But to do this, we have to work together from a city or at the very least a neighborhood perspective.
Going back to carbon issues, would you speak about how building materials might be used to sequester carbon?
Sure. This is interesting because there are a lot of materials that are getting pressed these days that they sequester carbon in their manufacturing process. So most building materials, concrete, cement in particular, emit a tremendous amount of carbon. There are some new materials on the market that say that they sequester carbon in their manufacturing process. Some of these are better than others. There was a cement product that came out last year that seemed to be the save-all, and it turns out it ate through rebar. So it's not a great product. However, there is a new product that I just read about a few weeks ago being developed in Great Britain that is actually made under the surface of the ocean. It extracts carbon, calcium carbonate, in the same sort of process that coral reefs are formed through, that seashells are formed through. And by running a very small current of electricity through a wire, calcium carbonate begins to build up on that wire and will build up as long as the wire has a little charge running through it. There's an architect, Michael Pawlyn, P-A-W-L-Y-N, out of Great Britain, who is working with a man who's been rebuilding coral reefs. And Michael Pawlyn is saying, hey, let's make our building materials out of this. In fact, we could wire up an entire building and have the building formed underwater. As crazy as it sounds, it's doable. People are doing it right now. So that's one thing. The city of Seattle, once these materials come online are really proven, this will be something easy for the city to write into its specs to give preferential treatment to using these kinds of products.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Jennifer Barnes, co-founder of Biomimicry Puget Sound and of the Seattle Urban Greenprint Project. How far along is the implementation of some of these ideas you've been talking about?
The physical implementation is yet to come. We have groups, subsets of Biomimicry Puget Sound who are taking on some of these issues as advocacy. We have some folks working to put together a proposal to give to the city about including evaporation in some of the regulations. We're also reaching out to other jurisdictions in the area about including evaporation in some of the city regulations. But the physical implementation is yet to come.
Do you think that the greatest opportunities are in new construction or in buildings that already exist in terms of implementing biomimicry-related projects?
Certainly new architecture, new design offers more opportunity to use biomimicry in a thoughtful way. Biomimicry, again, it's about function, and function needs to be thought of at the very, very beginning of new design projects. So those provide the most opportunity. That said, if we're talking about applying biomimicry at a city scale, the way the Urban Green Print is doing, we don't have the luxury to start from scratch, right? We have a whole city that's here. What we have, though, is opportunities at every turn. Every time a new road is built, every time we plant a garden in our own yards or do build a new building, we have opportunities to bring nature's lessons into those designs. In order to do that well, we really need to start to understand Seattle or any city as an interconnected ecosystem. Nature doesn't care about property lines. You know, ecosystems and organisms don't stop at certain neighborhood zones. So we need to think that way about our city. I will also say that now is the time to think about what city do we want to create for the next three generations. Now is the time to think that way. We can't wait until we have the opportunity to start a new city. We have to start planning now. So the way to do that is think about what's our vision, you know, our long-term vision. What kind of city do we want for our grandkids? And then to think, okay, how are we going to get there from here? And the Urban Green Print suggests that let's do it in partnership with nature. Let's learn from nature.
In Seattle, are there examples of biomimicry-inspired projects and or projects to restore the function of earlier ecosystems?
Yeah. Although it's not a building project, I would say the Living Building Challenge is a locally grown design standard that requires buildings that want to achieve living building certification to be net zero energy, waste, and water over 12 months of occupancy. So conceptually, that framework is asking how a building can function like a flower, harnessing all of its own energy and nutrients, managing all of its own waste, and being beautiful. So in my mind, this at its heart is about biomimicry in its most essential form. It's about how can we live in balance on the planet, learning lessons from nature about being part of a healthy closed-loop system. There is a certified living building at the Birchie School at the north end of Capitol Hill. This is a wonderful, really powerful project that changes the lives of the kids who attend classes in it. And also, of course, our local star these days, and I'm sure for many, many years, is the Bullitt Center, which is also pursuing living building status. I think this is a really interesting example of biomimicry because it challenges us to think about what biomimicry is. The building doesn't exhibit discrete strategies typically found when you talk about biomimicry in architecture. Most of those examples are in Europe, like emulating the process that I mentioned, you know, found in a camel's nostril to desalinate water, or building skins modeled after seed husks that protect the interior from overheating, or maybe air movement of termite mounds. I actually think the Bullitt Center takes biomimicry to a more meaningful level. The building is an example of mimicking nature at its most essential, collecting all of its own nutrients, managing all of its own waste, being built from local materials, celebrating light and air and healthy living. Several staff members who work there have said that they've lost weight since moving into the building because they bike to work and they climb those irresistible stairs. And so I think this project is generating health and vitality that goes way beyond its own building skin.
What is being planned for the Seattle Green Print project in the future?
We think of this project in three phases, and I've talked about phase one, which is really about research. Phase two is focused on community engagement. We're connecting with local property owners and project teams around projects that have already made positive gains towards reestablishing healthy ecosystem function. So we think that good work should be celebrated. We also want to create some healthy competition between projects by making that information public. So what we're doing is gathering information about those projects, and we'll be overlaying their ecosystem improvements onto an online map. One of our goals is for this map to remind people, again, that Seattle is this interconnected ecosystem. It's easy to forget that. We think that mapping these ecosystem improvements and visualizing the city as that interconnected ecosystem will also help the community identify physical and functional gaps where work needs to be done. So phase three will focus on implementation. We also think that just as every person has a unique fingerprint, every place has what we would call a unique green print. Ultimately, we would love to shepherd urban green print projects in other cities. And it's important that the body of the work done be done by people embedded in those communities. But we'd like to share lessons learned and also cross-pollinate these ideas with work being done in other places. That said, there's plenty of work in Seattle. There's enough work in Seattle to last a lifetime.
Are there particular challenges in implementing architectural projects that employ biomimicry intended to restore original ecosystems?
Yes, there are challenges. And I think the biggest challenge that we have for any truly sustainable work that we want to do has to do with the way we value our projects, actual economic valuation. We do not pay true ecological costs for anything that we build. We just don't consider the cost to our environment. That's why projects like the Bullitt Center are so important, because not only was it designed to be a living building, but every part of that project was designed to minimize its impact on the environment. So one of the most exciting things they're doing right now, a group is working with the Bullitt Foundation to analyze the ecosystem services, costs, and benefits that the building creates for the larger ecosystem. So this project is going to start to help to give us a language that will put a value on meaningful sustainability. Currently, there's no way to pencil it. Developers could care less. But the Bullitt Foundation is putting dollar figures to the impact, or more often the avoided impact, like avoided carbon emissions that the building is having on the environment. And that type of accounting is really critical if we ever want development to become truly sustainable.
To what extent do current laws and other public policies help or hinder green building?
There are some good changes to policy that are happening now. The city of Seattle has developed what they call the Living Building Pilot. This allows projects to request departures from land use code if they meet the Living Building Challenge fully or if they meet a particular suite of its imperatives. That's really good, helping us move the needle in the right direction. Statewide, there have been major strides around stormwater management over the last several years. Just the week before last, a hearings board upheld the Department of Ecology's stormwater permit changes, which, among other positive things, require that green infrastructure, so infrastructure mimicking natural systems, be the preferred choice for managing stormwater. And we're talking, as I mentioned, we're starting to talk with local jurisdictions about some of the ecological information that we're learning, some of the metrics around stormwater. And as we complete phase two of the green print, we'll have additional design guidelines that we'll be encouraging.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yeah, I think going back to what we initially talked about in terms of the deeper implications of biomimicry, that it really gives us an opportunity to shift our perspective away from thinking about how we can use nature or even enjoy nature, but really recognizing that nature is a mentor. What can we learn from nature? And sometimes it's just a matter of sitting with it, right? I think just slowing down and really listening, really paying attention. Nature has a lot that it can teach us.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Jennifer. You were just listening to Jennifer Barnes, co-founder of Biomimicry Puget Sound and of the Seattle Urban Greenprint Project. For more information, check on the web at urbangreenprint.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.